Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. On Friday, young people around the globe took part in marches to call on governments to take action on the climate crisis by ending the production of fossil fuels. Lorelei Crean, a 17-year-old activist in New York City, told Inside Climate News, quote, "We protest because the world hasn't listened. For years, scientists, activists, and people with lived experiences have been sounding the alarm about the climate crisis. Today, we walked out of over 25 schools across the city to amplify that alarm. The threat posed to our planet by the fossil fuel industry and climate change has never been clearer," end quote. Well, these actions took place just days before New York City Climate Week. It's an annual event organized by the nonprofit Climate Group, an international nonprofit whose mission is to drive climate action. NYC Climate Week coincides with the UN General Assembly session, which brings together activists, scientists, and journalists to discuss and amplify the urgency of climate action. According to a new report from Climate Central, this year is on track to be the hottest year on record. The summer months were exceptionally hot. The report says during June, July, and August, 50% of the world's population experienced unusually hot temperatures, and 25% did not get a break from the heat during the entire summer. Joining us to talk about the climate crisis and what is at stake in the upcoming election is Emily Atkin, author and founder of Heated, a newsletter devoted to climate accountability journalism and analysis on the climate crisis. Emily Atkin created Heated in 2019 after 6 years of covering climate politics for several outlets in Washington, D.C. Emily and her team recently launched a series called The Overlooked Climate Plans of Project 2025. Emily is also a contributing columnist at MSNBC. Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a nice introduction.
Well, thank you. So the election is in just 42 days. And we have to say we're shocked that the climate is not getting more attention in media coverage. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But can you first talk about what is at stake for the climate in this election?
Yeah, this is the most important election for the climate that we've ever faced. I mean, I know that your listeners, if they pay attention to climate change, have probably heard this for every presidential election, and for every presidential election, it's been true. And now it's probably the truest it's ever been. The reason I say that now is because in order to achieve 1.5 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure if that's a term that your listeners are familiar with, but it refers to essentially stabilizing a livable climate with really, really minimal, irreversible long-term effects. We have to worldwide achieve net zero emissions by the year 2050. In order to achieve net zero by 2050, we have to halve emissions. So cut emissions in half by the year 2030. Now, it's currently the year 2024. So you can see why the next election is exceedingly important for those deadlines, because if we're going to hit those targets, then the policies need to be in place. They need to continue to be in place to have emissions by 2030. The good news about that is that because of some big policies that have passed in the last couple of years, we're sort of on our way there, not fully there, but on our way towards cutting emissions really dramatically by 2030. But those policies have to remain in place. We have one presidential candidate that has pledged to keep those policies in place and one that has pledged to repeal them. So that's why we say that this election is really important for the climate. The policy that I'm referring to is the Inflation Reduction Act, signed by Biden a couple years ago, and which includes a lot of policies to spur clean energy development across the United States. That's a simplified explanation of it, but that's part of it. And if it is repealed, then we have less clean energy development and carbon goes up. So that's really the stakes of this election.
So to your point, in one of your recent pieces, you write, even if all Kamala Harris did in office was preserve the Biden administration's policies, her victory over Trump would still prevent the release of 4 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere by 2030, compared, an amount equating to $900 billion in climate damages avoided by preventing Trump from entering office. And this is because of Trump's pledges to end clean energy investments, repeal the nation's climate regulations, and turn the nation's oil spigots to full blast. And that's really just the beginning. So, Emily, I mean, you've written about why you think this is not getting the attention it deserves, but what you just laid out there, to think that the next president will take office in 2025 and will be there until 2029. So they're going to decide whether or not we take action by 2030. This is just so crucial.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons that it doesn't get a lot of attention is because it's kind of difficult to think about, number one. Look, neither a Harris presidency or a Trump presidency would put the U.S. on track to achieving that goal that we need to achieve by 2050, net zero. And I think that that can be really difficult for people to think about, because we want to think about things in black and white, like either we solve the climate crisis or we don't. And we hear something like that, I think it's so tempting to just think, well, we're screwed either way, right? If neither one of them are going to get us to net zero by 2050, then we're screwed either way. Let's just focus on something else. I mean, that's at least stuff that I hear from talking to voters and even just talking to friends and family who are used to hearing me talk about climate change all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to communicate, but I always try, that climate change is less like a cliff and more like a staircase. It's not like we stay on top of the cliff and we're fine, or we fall off the cliff and we're bad. There are hundreds of steps on the way to the ravine. And the difference in this election is about, which step do you want to be on? And that's complex. It's long-term thinking. And I think that also, at the same time, there are a lot of moneyed interests that really benefit from us not talking about climate change, from having that sort of, well, it's too late mindset, because the less that we pay attention to it, the less we demand action for it. And that, unfortunately, is a really profitable strategy for some of the biggest carbon intensive businesses in the United States. There's a reason why Trump asked the oil industry for $1 billion in exchange for repealing all of Biden's climate policies. It's because the oil industry has $1 billion to spare. Their profits have been incredible over the last decade. So yeah, there's a combination between it just being a difficult issue, I think, to think about and understand, and certain interests, moneyed interests, powerful interests, promoting ignoring it and promoting misunderstanding it and promoting misinformation, which is a really powerful tool with climate change.
And when you're talking about powerful people and institutions refusing to talk about the problem with accuracy and appropriate urgency, you write that the recent presidential debate on ABC was a perfect illustration of this. The moderators saved climate change for the last possible moment of the 90-minute event and asked only what the candidates would do to tackle it. You write, for this incredibly broad and existentially important question, they gave the candidates only 1 minute each to respond.
Yeah, I mean, I've now been covering climate change in a national political sense since 2013, so like 11 years. And from that, I've covered many debates. And sometimes I just feel like it's very frustrating. This happens almost every election cycle. It kind of stopped happening in the 2020 election cycle when we had a really robust Democratic primary full of candidates. But yeah, we're sort of back into that ignoring of the issue on a, but like the way that media treats it, I feel, and have experienced is not in proportion to how big of an issue it really is.
Today, we're speaking with Emily Atkin, author and founder of Heated, a newsletter devoted to climate accountability journalism and analysis on the climate crisis. If you have any questions or comments for Emily about the work that she does with her team, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of the climate crisis? What are you hearing out there? If you've seen anything that you'd like to highlight, we'd love to hear from you. And we always ask this question, but why isn't this urgent issue getting the attention that it deserves? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You also write that you've been hearing people say that climate change is not a driving force in the election because it's not a relevant issue in people's day-to-day lives. I mean, we're hearing about the economy, rightly so, every day. And you write, if you care about the fact that food prices and inflation are skyrocketing, that water and electric bills are through the roof, that healthcare costs just keep getting higher, or that the American dream of owning a home is out of most people's reach, then guess what? You care deeply about climate change. Rising temperatures made worse by unchecked fossil fuel expansion are driving all of these problems, and they'll all spiral out of control if we don't quickly tackle the crisis. But the evidence is solid. Climate is the kitchen table issue of our lifetimes. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, it's always so interesting to hear when I talk to voters, when I'm doing my reporting, trying to understand where does climate change fit into your political decision making. It's common for when I'm not, you know, in an activist space talking to climate activists, for people to say, like, of course I care about climate change, but I'm under a lot of stress with my, let's say, my utility bill. So I'm really wanting to prioritize who will make the economy better. And then there's always the question of, well, why is your utility bill so high? You know, when we have wildfires and we have natural disasters and we have flooding, the utility reliability suffers. And climate change is making disasters way more common, particularly flooding disasters, droughts, you know, rainfall, all of extreme heat, which really stresses the grid. And that's one reason. There are a number of studies that show that extreme weather is leading to higher utility bills. And for some reason, there's still just not that connection between people saying, like, oh, I have a higher utility bill, maybe climate change is part of that. And that's another challenge. Food prices. Rising temperatures are predicted to drive up food inflation by like 1-3% every year by 2035, according to some studies, as crop yields are suffering from extreme heat. There is and you know, your housing costs. I mean, climate change is making certain properties uninsurable. The entire state of Florida is becoming uninsurable. There are connections that you can make to almost every kitchen table issue to climate change. There are obviously different issues. There are like a number of reasons why the economy is bad, but climate change is certainly one of them. The problem is that it has become almost politicized to mention that. I think that just going back to the idea of why is this not a big, why does it seem like people aren't talking about this as a climate change as much as they should be? And what I've experienced as a reporter is that trying to point out the climate connection to something will immediately get you accused by a certain group of people that you are being an alarmist, that you don't have evidence, that you're a Democrat radical. There's been a really successful movement funded primarily by carbon-intensive industries to associate concern about climate change with crazy political alarmism. So even in my industry, even in the journalism industry, you know, journalists are so obsessed with seeming fair and seeming reasonable and getting lobbed that accusation all the time that you're an alarmist and you're political for pointing out the climate connections to things, that will have an effect on the coverage because, you know, trust and perception, if the audience believes that you're being political, then you'll lose that trust, you'll lose that readership. So you'll see a lot of mainstream media organizations dial it back, try to sound a little less alarmed. But the thing is that this problem that we're facing is objectively alarming. You don't have to, if you're just reading peer-reviewed science all day, which is what so much of my own career is, you know, you want to be fair, but what you realize is that it's fair to say that this is concerning, this is alarming, we should be talking about this, but there are consequences to that in how you're perceived and what you'll be accused of.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I guess I'm a little confused about a couple of things. One, I share your guess, perplexion about why it is that the public doesn't seem to understand where the situation we're in and how you would get beyond that. I don't know what the explanation is. Denial, people are just delusional or what? That's one thing. Secondly, it may be that the Biden administration policies might cut emissions by the amount that she stated, but the COP in 2015 said you had to cut global emissions by half by 2030. We're not on track, in the United States at least, and even globally, to cut them in half. And we've got 5 years left. They've been going up. They increased a little bit during the pandemic, but 2023 was the highest year on record. 2024 is going to be even higher. So I don't see how you get down to cutting it in half by 2025 unless there's some kind of dramatic reduction taking place. And I'm not even sure how that's going to happen.
Thank you, Greg. What are your thoughts, Emily?
Your listener is absolutely correct. And it's completely valid, completely based in fact, according to this very same analysis that, you know, that we were talking about that I like to cite in my reporting, neither a Biden presidency or a Harris presidency would not put the U.S. on track to cutting emissions in half by 2030. That is the benchmark needed to prevent catastrophic warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. In order to reach that, a Harris administration would have to, and I say this because I don't think a Trump administration just would do it, but yeah, a Trump administration would have to do this as well. Any administration would have to implement significant new climate policy measures, and they would have to center on scaling down the fossil fuel economy in an incredibly radical way. To be completely realistic, of course, I don't see that either. I mean, and if you watched the debate, you saw that even at that one climate change question that happened, Trump didn't say anything. And Harris essentially said that she would preserve climate policies while also protecting fossil fuels. That can't happen if you want to achieve halving emissions by 2030. So that's why I say earlier that, so that reality is enough to turn people off from wanting to solve climate change completely, right? If we're not going to make that target, then why would I care? And that's why I try to promote this understanding of climate change as a staircase and not a cliff. Because if you look at where, let's say, even the policies in place right now would take us, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's like halfway down the staircase versus repealing all those policies, and then you're at the bottom of the ravine. Every single stair represents hundreds of millions of dollars, millions of lives, you know, healthcare costs, natural disaster costs. Climate change can, you know, obviously the goal is always going to be to not have any climate change damages or to really stabilize and hit those targets. But if we're not going to hit those targets, I don't think it's ethical to say, well, then let's just say screw it and hit the bottom of the ravine. Mm-hmm. Yet we obviously have to keep pushing, you know. I think the job of journalists is really to hold political administrations accountable for the amount that they're doing and the amount that they're not doing, right? So you'll see a Harris administration say, like, we're the most historic administration ever. You know, we've done the most on climate change compared to any administration, so we're really climate friendly. Well, that's not actually, like, that comparison. If you've done the most on climate change compared to any administration, that doesn't mean you've done enough. That just means you've done more than everybody else who has mostly done nothing. So I guess good job, but there's still, your listener is absolutely correct. There's so much more to be done. And the amount of stairs that are still left are very daunting. And so I understand where they're coming from.
Right. And the United States is producing more oil and gas today than ever before.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating if you care about climate change. You know, the Biden administration will tout the Inflation Reduction Act all day. But at the same time, you know, his administration has presided over record expansions of oil, LNG exports, approved major fossil fuel projects like the Willow Project, the Mountain Valley Pipeline. That can be incredibly frustrating. And if you're a climate activist, you know, I hear this from climate activists all the time, that how am I supposed to fight for an administration that does that? And it's a difficult question to answer. I know a lot of people are just still in it because what they're fighting for is not an administration, but a livable climate.
Well, thank you for the question, Greg. Let's go next to Tina in Oakland. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much. Thank you always for doing these climate and environmental programs, Rose. It's so important. My question is, how can we address Donald voters who think he is a peaceful candidate, despite all his drill baby drill rhetoric, when they say, you know, that way we won't depend on foreign oil? And these are people who went through the Bush-Cheney establishment of creating, you know, fake wars for oil. So they feel like they make a point, and this is why they see him as an anti-establishment candidate. And how do we address that? How do we say, the only way I can do it ever is say, well, we mostly depend on Canadian oil, but that doesn't get me very far. So what can I say to in an argument with those voters?
Yeah,
thank
that's
you so
tough.
Much, Tina.
That's, yeah, thank you very much. That's tough. I mean, I think the number one thing I would say there is, did you listen to the debate? Because if there was one thing that I felt like Harris made clear, it was that she loved fracking and would increase domestic gas production for energy independence. So just the argument that Trump is somehow the energy independent candidate versus Harris, that just doesn't seem based in fact to me. She's seemed to be really gung-ho for domestic fossil fuel production, which is obviously not in line with what needs to happen for the climate, but I think could help in that argument with whoever you're having that argument with. I tend to find that arguments like these are a bit of a trap because they're being made by people who don't care about climate change. In general, well, at least when I've had these arguments, that's people that bring up domestic energy production and energy independence as a straw man to say that this is why we can't address climate change. And I tend to just try to avoid those arguments in general by saying, like, I think that we can do both things. You know, I think that we can do, I think that the generally the people making those arguments too don't believe that there is any capability for renewable sources to replace fossil fuels on a large scale within the next, you know, 20 years. And that's not entirely true. There are a ton of studies showing that if we really had the political will, we could replace a lot of our infrastructure with fossil fuel infrastructure with renewable infrastructure if we really wanted to. But the idea that it's impossible or we can't do it, it's going to be hard to argue with those people. Honestly, what I would really recommend is not arguing with those people, because we don't actually need those people who already don't want to do anything about climate change in order to achieve meaningful climate action. There's a really great, I encourage your listeners to look at the Yale Climate Communications studies on global warming, Six Americas. It'll show you how much of the population aligns with whether they're concerned, alarmed, disengaged, whatever. There's six different categories of people. And those people who are doubtful or don't want to do anything about climate change, they don't make up that much of America. It's really the people in the middle who kind of care, but it's not a priority for them, that makes up the big chunk of America. So I would focus on trying to have conversations with people who are disengaged rather than actively trying to deny the problem or push back against the problem.
Well, Tina, thank you so much for the question. We're going to continue talking about this next Monday. We'll also do a show about Trump's foreign policy, because we hear that also on a regular basis. Emily, final thoughts from you about what is at stake and how you're going to cover the election, given that it's only 42 days from now.
Yeah, I think that what I'm really energized by, so I'm in New York City right now for Climate Week, which is this large nonprofit organized, week of climate change events paired with the UN General Assembly. And there's a lot of on the ground activism that happens here that doesn't get covered a lot. And that's really where I think I want to focus my efforts this week, is talking to people who are pushing really hard to get climate in front of not only voters and politicians, but some of the corporations that are, that are really emitting a lot of carbon or pushing back against climate policies, and trying to spend my time highlighting the voices of people who are really doing the work and making the arguments to get climate change as a higher issue in people's minds. So I'm really excited about that. I hope that people read along. They can go to Heated, which is my newsletter, to follow along. But yeah, those people that tend to give me a little bit of hope about this issue not becoming buried in the sidelines.
Emily Atkin is author and founder of Heated, a newsletter devoted to climate accountability journalism and analysis on the climate crisis. You can find her work at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Thanks so much for joining us, Emily. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it'd be great.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will find out about Get Out the Vote efforts for those who care about climate issues. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about what is being done to make sure that people who care about the planet vote. When voters cast their ballots in the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, many were driven by their concern for the climate. According to the University of Colorado Boulder's Center for Environmental Futures report, well, a recent poll by the Environmental Voter Project and Beacon Research shows that among registered voters ages 18 to 34 in five battleground states, Kamala Harris is ahead of Donald Trump by 12 points. So how decisive are young voters and voters who are concerned about the climate in this election? Nathaniel Stinnett is founder and executive director of the Environmental Voter Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit that identifies non-voting environmentalists and transforms them into consistent voters to build the power of the environmental movement. 7,000 volunteers are hoping to mobilize almost 5 million climate voters. Hi, Nathaniel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back. Thank you. Matthew Burgess is assistant professor at the University of Wyoming College of Business. His research focuses on political polarization, economic growth, and natural resource management. Hi, Matthew. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rose. And just to clarify for your listeners, I used to be the director of the Center for Social and Environmental Futures at CU Boulder, and I was the lead author on the report you mentioned. So that's probably why I'm here.
Thanks for having me back. Well, thank you so much. So, Matthew, let's start off with you. Because of the Electoral College, the last election was decided by only 44,000 votes in three states. We heard from Emily about the climate. She and so many of us are concerned that it's just not getting the attention it deserves in this election. But it is so crucial. A lot of people truly care about it and they're voting on it. So what role is the climate playing in this election?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So our research estimated that climate change could have had an impact in the last two elections, particularly 2020, favoring the Democrats. And, you know, there's no perfect way to, you can't run an experiment that runs the world without climate change and with climate change. But our best guess was that it could have had a big enough impact to change the outcome in favor of President Biden, given that the election was so close. This election is very interesting. And there's kind of three dynamics going on at the same time that affect how climate affects this 2024 election. So the first is that there still is a strong preference among voters for the Democrats over the Republicans on this issue. So there's a recent poll that I saw, for example, that I think was from Quinnipiac, that had the Democrats ahead by 25 points on that particular issue, which was the largest by far, I think, of any other issue, abortion being, you know, somewhat of a close second. At the same time, it's not a huge fraction of voters that say climate change is their number one issue in terms of voting. It's more common to hear issues like the economy, immigration, abortion in some cases. So there's that tension. And then also, as you noted, it doesn't seem like either candidate is talking much about climate change on the campaign trail this year. And my best guess is that that has something to do with the incentives related to this particular election. So on the Democrat side, Vice President Harris was part of the administration that passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the biggest federal climate bill in U.S. history. But we're also in an economic moment where inflation, you know, has just come down, and that's still a concern. The national debt is still a concern. Although there is about a 2-to-1 preference for do something over do nothing on climate change, there's not a national appetite, at least in the polls that I've seen, for things like a fracking ban. And so it may be that Vice President Harris feels like there's not a lot new that she can promise in terms of big legislation in the next term. So it's best not to talk about it, given that she's already, you know, leading on this issue. And then for former President Trump, one of the things I think is interesting about him is he has not called climate change a hoax or outright denied it, at least for a few months, as far as I've seen. I wonder if that's because he's seen polling now that I think pretty clearly shows that independents and moderate Republicans and young Republicans do have a preference now that's growing, similar to Democrats, for do something on the issue versus do nothing. But the primary incentives can be a little bit different. And so it's a little bit of a challenging tightrope to walk for Republicans who are running for statewide or federal office. And with VP Harris, it's you know, she's running on a record that is pretty strong historically in terms of what's been able, other presidents have been able to pass. And she may not feel like she can promise much more, particularly given that the biggest concern about her among independent voters, I believe, or one of them, is that she's too liberal.
Nathaniel, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think Matt brought up a whole bunch of good points, but one of them that I think is really important to stress, and that is this difference between voter priorities and voter preferences. As Matt rightly points out, broad majorities of Americans would prefer politicians to lead on climate. But very, very few Americans list climate as their number one priority. And the simple truth is, when people go in to vote, they're not making their decision based on the like 17th most important issue in their mind. They're making their vote based on one or two or three issues at most. And right now, the climate movement doesn't have enough climate-first voters to really push politicians around. And so I think both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are aware of that. The second thing that I would bring up is it isn't like both of these politicians are walking onto a blank slate here and 100% of America is up for grabs. No, they're walking into a largely calcified political map where maybe there are seven battleground states that are going to decide the election. And then within those states, there are a whole bunch of people who are going to vote Democrat no matter what, a whole bunch of people who are going to vote Republican no matter what. There are a whole bunch of people who are going to vote, a whole bunch of people who are going to stay home. And within that environment, there are very few swing voters. Now, there are two types of swing voters, people who are deciding between the two candidates, and then also people who are deciding whether to vote or not. But even there, we're talking about a small group of Americans that Trump and Harris are now fighting over. And we need to view all climate messaging within that really small, narrow window, because that's where the election's going to be won or lost. And that's how campaigns are thinking about it right now.
Can you both give us a sense of what these voters are thinking? Because we've been doing shows around the climate crisis and all things related to the planet on Mondays since 2016. So we are deep into this. We read about it on a regular basis. We know what's at stake. We've had on so many amazing scientists who say we have to act by 2030. So that's where we are. But we understand that a lot of people don't read about climate on a regular basis, although most people are affected by it. So what are you hearing from these voters who might not be reading about this and don't hear from these scientists? They know that something's off because it's hotter where they live, the floods are more intense, the hurricanes are more intense. But you know, do they understand what's really at stake here? I mean, do they know what will happen if Trump wins? Of course, a lot of activists say they really would like the Democrats to do more. But the fact is, if Trump wins, we know what he's going to do based on the last 4 years and then what he has said. Drill, 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 repeal Biden's climate policies. Do voters know about this? Do you want to take that first, Nathaniel?
I mean, in short, no, they don't know about it, Rose. you know, I think for those of us who spend all of our time thinking about politics and climate, it is really hard to imagine either a low information voter or someone who doesn't spend all their time thinking about politics and climate. Now, I overstated it. Like, obviously, there is a baseline level of knowledge among voters, and certainly there are large majorities of Americans who are somewhat concerned about climate change, but are they aware of the stakes in the way that you just rightly set them out to be? No, they're not. Most Americans don't spend much time thinking about politics or the climate crisis at all. And many of them, as hard as it is to imagine, are just starting to tune in right now. They're just starting to tune in right now. Mm-hmm. And I think there are two things, two sort of examples that highlight this disconnect between how, say, people like all of us think about politics and climate, and maybe the broader electorate does. So the first is the Inflation Reduction Act. I think by any objective measure, people have to admit that the Inflation Reduction Act was maybe the largest climate law ever passed in like global history. It was just enormous, and it's going to be impactful. Based on our recent polling data at the Environmental Voter Project, of already registered young people in the United States, 38% of them had never even heard of it, never even heard the words Inflation Reduction Act. Beyond that, 65% of young people had no idea that there were climate provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. Just no idea whatsoever. And this is something that you've probably done multiple shows on, Rose. So that's the first thing to just sort of recognize. The second is you ask about the stakes. And no, most people aren't paying attention to politics closely enough that they understand how our future paths will diverge when it comes to addressing the climate crisis based on whether Kamala Harris is the next president or Donald Trump is. And that's something that all of us in the media and all of us in the climate movement and all of us in academia need to do a better job on.
It's such a good reality check, Nathaniel. Matthew, what would you add?
Yeah, I just had a couple things. First of all, off the bat, you know, unlike your other two guests, I'm a Canadian citizen and a professor at a public university, so I'm absolutely not here to tell anybody who to vote for. I'm just here to summarize the data as best I can. But what I will say is, I think one of the things really interesting right now with climate change is that there's so much going on in the private sector in terms of renewable technologies becoming market competitive. And if you combine that with the fact that there is this growing consensus that we need to do something, there's actually, in a way, it makes the what happened, you know, who's in the White House maybe less important than it was before. Obviously, there's still difference in their platforms, and I encourage you all to read them and vote based on your preferences. But, you know, let me give you a couple of examples. I believe Texas is leading the country in renewable energy generation. Even in the past administration from President Trump, when his rhetoric about climate was maybe even stronger than it is now in the particular direction, the White House budget request, I believe, every year asked for significant cuts to climate science, and Congress increased climate science funding every year, partly because of rank-and-file Republicans. There's a really good Politico article that came out in February called Trump versus an Emerging Republican Climate Strategy. Right now, there's over 80 Republicans in the Conservative Climate Caucus, which is one of the largest caucuses in the House of Representatives. And there are growing, industries and therefore industry lobbies and industry constituencies in renewables. The state where I just moved to recently, Wyoming, is a great example. I believe we're the most fossil-dependent state in the country or one of the top three, but we also have tons of wind. We have great geology for carbon capture. We've been exploring big nuclear projects. Some rancher recently found an enormous deposit of rare earth minerals that you need for batteries in his ranch, right? And I believe our Republican governor has talked about net zero in the past. We've also done research looking in my group, looking at state-level climate policies, and we found that between 2015 and 2020, there were over 100 that were passed by bipartisan, like decarbonization policies passed bipartisanly. We had a study that came out also recently that found that electric utilities are now more ambitious than state renewable portfolio policies on average, including in some states that are you know very conservative and don't have any renewable portfolio policies. So I guess what I would just say with this is the momentum of renewable technologies and the energy transition. You know, Rocky Mountain Institute recently projected that fossil fuel demand either has peaked or will peak, you know, in the next few years. we've gotten to a point where a lot of the technologies are mature enough that I think the momentum is really unstoppable in terms of the transition. And so, you know, for sure, wherever you stand on any particular issue, the president of the United States is maybe the most important person in the world, right? Take it from a Canadian. And so it's an important decision, and I encourage everybody to vote and to make it informed choices. But I don't think it's the case. You know, President Biden, for example, had more fossil fuel production under his watch than President Trump did. I think that we're in an interesting point where there are some upheavals in the world that have affected the salience of climate, maybe relative to other issues. But there's also been some just exponential technological progress and deployment of renewables that I think make the transition pretty unstoppable at this point, and also more aligned with American innovation, American business competitiveness, American exceptionalism, and private enterprise than maybe, you know, it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Mm. It's also important to note, Emily points out that in Project 2025, developed for Trump by the Heritage Foundation, it proposes gutting the EPA and its climate regulations, reopening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling, defunding the nationwide transition to renewables, and eliminating environmental justice initiatives. And that's just the beginning. We've only got about 30 seconds left. Nathaniel, when these issues are laid out for maybe people who don't pay attention very closely, but these issues are laid out, do people then tend to say, you know what, this is so important, I am going to vote?
Well, sometimes. I know that's not the cut and dry answer you were looking for, Rose, but it's the honest one. I mean, the truth is, what mobilizes environmentalists to vote more than anything else is looking around at their peers and seeing that all of them are becoming more political. You know, a lot of our research at the Environmental Voter Project shows that sitting down and trying to rationally convince someone of the value of voting because they care about climate or the environment might make us feel good, but it's not nearly as motivating as using little things like peer pressure. And so we encourage environmentalists to just be loud and proud about the fact that they are going to be politically engaged this year. That is so much more powerful than laying out the stakes.
Well, really important information. Nathaniel Stinnett is founder and executive director of the Environmental Voter Project. Matthew Burgess is assistant professor at the University of Wyoming College of Business. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.